Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi, welcome to the podcast. I'm Genuinely Grace. Apologies if the sound is slightly different. I've had some techie issues, but hopefully it'll be okay. What a week it's been. In the press, there's been so much, hasn't there, about booze again and the whole study around dementia, the link with dementia and alcohol. I mean, I'm really glad they're talking about it. It's time, isn't it? It's really time that we do start to hear that, you know, that even one glass is toxin, right? It's poison. Let's be clear about this. You've heard me say it 1,000 times. But that article was picked up again and mentioned again in Female magazine in the Mail this week. You might have seen the article with the lovely Jenny Murray. And I think I mentioned her before because she wrote in her column a while back that she knew that she needed to give up, note that phrase, drinking. And she was worried that across the pandemic, across the lockdown, she was becoming an alcoholic, you know, her words. And then there was a whole 2-3 page spread in the Mail. How I beat my bottle of night lockdown habit, she says, with a 5-2 drink diet. So she shares this diary of how she sort of went into moderation, as it were. She says it hasn't been easy sitting alone and sober after 1 o'clock. And you just kind of read through this diary of, you know, I won't go through it all, but I found it absolutely fascinating. But the truth of it is, I found it utterly exhausting, even just to read it. It was utterly exhausting that she's going on about how worried she is about her health and how she's always enjoyed, you know, a glass of wine, but she realizes that, you know, now it's linked to dementia and et cetera, et cetera. And she started trying to have single drinks, you know, rather than buying a bottle. And then that would turn to a double, of course. And then she talks about how, you know, she documents the days that she managed one day without any alcohol. And, you know, she thought it was very strange, but it was okay. And then the next day she had one can of Pimm's, and then the next day she had a small beer, and then another day she was on a train, and, you know, so, and so it goes on. But the point I'm trying to make is I read this article and I actually just thought, oh, sweetheart, your life would just be so much better if you just could grasp this fact that life is better without the booze. And of course, I completely understand where she's at. I was in that place many times. Oh my God, how many times did I go around the block? Desperately trying to moderate, desperately trying to put a lid on it, put a cap on it, arguing with myself, forcing willpower onto myself. It's exhausting, exhausting. Nobody ever told me, you know, nobody ever said to me, hold on, why are you doing this? Just live without any alcohol and your life will change so much for the better. It's off the scale. You know, as I've said last week, I've got a lovely client who keeps saying, I've been given a second chance at life, right? Now, those people were not at rock bottom. I wasn't at rock bottom. Just about everyone in the sober club, you know, there's one or two who had some hairy moments, but mostly we weren't at rock bottom, just like Jenny Murray wasn't at rock bottom. But why would you want to wait till you get there? You know, when you read this article, you kind of realize she's still in the alcohol trap. She still is. It's all she can talk about and think about. You know, which day is she going to have one? Oh, my God, I said I'd only have one. I said I wouldn't drink on Saturday, and on and on and on. It's literally exhausting. And you just know that when something tips up in her life, if it ever does, God forbid, she'll be straight back down the booze elevator. So anyways, Jenny, if you're listening, I would love to help you ditch the booze properly. You know, life is richer for it. Sobriety rocks, right? We are the lucky ones and all of those phrases. So, yeah, that's kind of consumed my week looking at that and just, oh, my God. And Lucy Rock has commented. She did a really nice little piece in there. And she said in the Mail, you know, rehearse your script for saying no to drinks, or, you know, gave a whole bunch of tips. But ultimately, those of you who are moderating, if you are a mindful drinker, of course, I'm not judging you. You know, if it works for you, it works for you. But there's just a couple of rules that I'd say, please put in place. You know, if you're going to do a Jenny Murray and moderate, and you think that's, you know, that's okay, then do set your rules in place. Absolutely do your prep. Make it completely non-negotiable in terms of the days and how much you'll drink. And then, and this is the really big kicker, actually commit, you know, really, really promise yourself that you'll never have a drink when you're really upset or angry or fearful, even if it's on a designated drink day, right? And also, here's the interesting one, promise yourself that you'll never have a drink when it's a big celebration. Well, that knocks out quite a bit. Obviously, the reason is that when we do drink to sort out an issue, you know, because we're upset, because we're you know, fearful, because we're angry, obviously what that tells our unconscious mind is, you know, we need alcohol to solve that problem. When, of course, that's utterly ridiculous. Nothing is made better by alcohol. Nothing, nothing at all. And similarly, when we have alcohol to celebrate, that just cements in that attitude that alcohol is the social glue that sticks everything together. And without it, we can't be happy. We can't be joyous. We can't celebrate. It's all absolute BS. The emperor isn't wearing any clothes. Just, you know, if you're now at a point where a little voice in your head is saying, maybe it's time, you know, maybe I would be better off physically and emotionally without the booze, then you owe it to yourself. Do this. Just do it. Set yourself a challenge of 100 days. There you go. I've challenged you. Don't do 28 because you'll be bang on Christmas. 100 days. And, you know, get some support. Come and join the Sober Club. Meet some friends who have done it, been there, done this, got the T-shirt. Don't expect your own family to be able to support you on this because they, you know, maybe haven't had the same experience. But honestly, you know, it's not just me. There are many, many, many of us that will tell you that life is so much better without the booze. Those people who are planning parties and stuff, by the way, I've had a bunch of Sober Club members kind of, they've been feeling very strong, very, very cool about everything until, you know, kind of very recently when they've started to have a little wobble about going out and socializing for Christmas. And so I'm going to give you my top tips in a minute, a few of them. I'll do more of this as the weeks go by, but I'll give you a few top tips because I think some of the Christmas parties start next week. And we're starting early this year to get some in to replace last year. Anyways, before I do any of that, I want to tell you about this fantastic brand called Undrunk. I love the name, who are on a mission to deliver the world's best alcohol-free spirits right to your door. Now, you know that my line is keep the ritual, change the ingredients. And of course, you're going to want to, you know, try some of these fantastic alcohol-free drinks. But actually getting hold of them is sometimes a hassle. You may not want to get to the supermarket. You might want a brand that isn't in the supermarket. You might not, you know, have time to place your online order. So you can literally cut out the faff and then, you know, have Undrunk bring you the spirits that have been tried and tested and super loved. And Steph, who is the creator, has got an interesting story. Stopping drinking in 2019, couldn't find that many great options. Of course, there's loads of choices, but you never know what's going to be great. So Steph and her team spent months scouring the market. And then fast forward to April 2021. So it's quite a new brand. She launched Undrunk. And the whole idea is to take that overwhelm away and have this kind of bespoke service. So they now offer this subscription service that bring you new and really great low and no alcohol spirits of all kinds. So they pick, you know, a new one or a one that they particularly love each month. From the finest distillers around the globe. So every month it will be a different box and you'll get a delicious gin alternative, or it might be whiskey, a whiskey alternative or tequila or whatever, you know, there's loads of different ones. But then here's the really cool bit. Then they carefully pair the alcohol-free spirit with great mixers and also garnish. So you get some funky stuff and then wait for it. They give you the snacks. I love this. So they also add in to their box a selection of sweet and savory snacks and, you know, really nice artisan healthy stuff. And of course, the occasional a cheeky extra alcohol-free drink to try out. And then they've got a mag as well. So it's such a lovely brand, a fantastic gift if you wanted to gift someone this subscription, you know, for Christmas. Or, of course, gift yourself. It's all about self-care, right? So you need to check out undrunk.co.uk, undrunk.co.uk, and have a look at that subscription box. And also, they have offered a really fabulous competition for us, which I think is to win a 3-month subscription. So a very cool prize. So check out the show notes and go to imperfectlynatural.com, my other site, for details of that competition. So a really exciting product. It's just so brilliant that there's so many more great alcohol-free alternatives around. It makes life just so much easier for people who are not drinking. And my absolute top tip is, if you are going out to a Christmas party, then always, but always take your own alcohol-free drinks. Don't expect the host to have gotten something in for you. You know, they might not, but take your own, because you can be sure that they'll probably want some of yours anyway. So, so you're going to need extra. So let's just have a quick look at a few top tips then for this social period. Bossing your sober Christmas, part one, this is. All right. So you know what I'm going to suggest you do before a Christmas party, because you've heard me say this a ton of times. I'm going to suggest that you do a whoop on your Christmas party or your Christmas social. Whoop, of course, stands for wish, outcome, obstacle, plan. So if you've got something coming up, you know, ask yourself, what's my wish for this event? What do I want it? What do I want to happen? Do I want to be alcohol free and fully present and happy, healthy, sober? There's a good book title. What's the outcome? So what will it really look like then? Can you visualize yourself enjoying yourself without booze and having fun and chatting to your friends or your family, getting home at a decent time, getting into bed without any regrets, you know, waking up the next day, being able to go out early in the morning. And then the next O is for obstacles. So be realistic here and ask yourself, what will the obstacles be? Is it sober shamers? Is it people telling you, oh, don't be daft, you can just have one? Is it the voice in your head? Have you got that really kind of strong self-sabotage? Or is it, as is often the case, that there is nothing nice to drink instead of booze? In which case, you know, you need your undrunk box. You need to check out ahead of time what you're going to be drinking. And then the P is for plan. Plan and prepare how you are going to rock it sober. And do give your friends a heads up. You know, give them a ring and just say, hey, I'm not drinking, so more for you. Or, hey, I'm not drinking, so here's how you can support me. Just don't mention it. I'm good. I've got my alcohol-free drinks. I'm good. And do decide what you'll drink in advance. Stock up, as we've already said, and the healthy snacks. That is important, because you might feel a bit hungrier. And then use whatever tools you need to use. You might want to drive to the occasion, so you know you're coming home, or book your taxi, because God knows, you know, Jenny Murray in that article talks about how boring it is to sit being sober. You know what? I don't think so. I think being drunk is boring. It really is boring when you start repeating yourself, and so does everybody else around you. So yeah, book your taxi home, because you might want to leave early, and plan something great, you know, for the next day. And don't forget as well, this is a conversation we've been having in the Sober Club recently. Every festive event does not have to involve drinking. Why not change it up? One of our members, instead of just going out for drinks with people she normally sees before Christmas, they've planned a murder mystery event, right? So they're all going to do an activity together, which is, you know, it's kind of fun, isn't it? You know, that word fun, which we all forgot about when we were drinking, right? Well, I most certainly did. Anyway, so there's just a few tips. I've got lots more for you. If you do decide you want to join the Sober Club, we've got so much content around how you can boss your Christmas sober, including, of course, a great recipe for alcohol-free mulled wine, which is always a winner in this weather as well. So I want to introduce you to this week's guest. We have had Cheryl Rickman on the podcast before. She's a prolific author. I don't know how she does it. She gets so many books out there. And we have spoken to her before about how to navigate loneliness. But I thought it was well worth getting her back on the podcast, because this topic is, as you will well know, something incredibly close to my heart. I spend my whole time banging on about self-care, and I actually mean self-care, you know, not booking yourself into a spa. I mean, that's lovely, but most of us can't do it most of the time. Although Shanti's was great last week, by the way. No, I mean little things. I mean, you know, appreciating yourself and actually creating a life that you don't have to escape from with booze. So I thought that this book with you know, Cheryl, we can't miss this one. Cheryl is author of You Are Enough. So enjoy the interview. You know, one of the phrases that I say an awful lot to my clients is "You Are Enough." And that's the title of a great new book by Cheryl Rickman. You Are Enough, Embrace Your Flaws and Be Happy Being You. What a fabulous sentiment. Welcome, Cheryl.
Hi there. Thank you.
Oh, I'm so chuffed for you. It's just such a great book. And you know, it's one of the phrases that's been used a lot in recent years. But it's brilliant that you've actually sort of unpacked it all and actually, you know, brought some meaning to it. So just before we get into it, just tell us a little bit about your background for anyone who hasn't heard you, because I've interviewed you before.
Yeah, I've I started to study positive psychology in 2015, and yeah, I've written a ghostwriter, so I've written books for other people, but started writing books to help people kind of fret less and flourish more, and sort of inspired by the loss of both my parents and wanting to help people make the most of their lives, I guess. Mm. And this book is very much from that sentiment. You know, we're told a lot of the time to kind of abide by societal, I call them the shackles of should, that, you know, society tells us we should look a certain way, or we should behave a certain way, or should want a certain dream to come true. And it can be quite restrictive and make us feel like we don't measure up. And so I wanted to write something that speaks to people and, like you say, unpacks all of that, really.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. Just tell us a little bit about, if for anyone who doesn't really know what positive psychology is, just explain that for us.
Yeah, so psychology was very much about getting people from sort of not very well to neutral. Mm. And positive psychology is really the study of getting people from, well, it's north of neutral, so flourishing. Mm. So, you know, focusing on interventions that can really make you sort of function really well.
Yeah.
Really kind of just developing that sort of side of things. So focusing on the good and counting your blessings. Mm. And also obviously understanding that there's a whole spectrum of emotion and it's okay to feel not good sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's sort of acceptance of that as well, but it's more about the sort of trying to flourish in life.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, it links so well with the work that I do around positive sobriety, because, you know, similarly with sobriety, we don't have to wait until we are unwell to come back to a neutral state. We can actually start from where we are now and embrace the fact that how much better life is going to be when you're not actually hampering yourself with a toxic liquid. So it links really well. And, you know, one thing I'm always talking about is how, you know, how exciting it is to actually look towards creating a life that you haven't got to escape from, you know, so that you actually are willing to step into. And as you say, that doesn't necessarily mean everything's going to be perfect, of course. Kind of doesn't work that way, does it? Let's you know, dig into this topic then. What is the issue? I know in the book you talk about how really this goes back to the fact that we are actually hardwired to seek approval of others.
Yes. It's basically an ancient kind of survival response, that we are kind of wired to care what other people think about us because we were part of tribes, and we're wired really to fear rejection because we didn't want to get booted out of a tribe, because fending for yourself back in when, you know, in the Stone Age times, was a dangerous kind of thing. So social acceptance and belonging are very important to our brains. Mm. So what we do is we seek out, we kind of define how well we're doing from a sort of combination of things, but from external feedback, including what society says we ought to be doing and so on, and expectations yeah. that are put on us by externally. And then inner self-talk, which obviously, you know, inner critic and imposter syndrome and all these different things. But unfortunately, what a lot of people don't realise is a lot of that data that we're basing our self-worth on is actually incorrect or inaccurate and inflexible. And it's often based on beliefs that we've sort of thought process that we've thought about over time to become beliefs. And they can be actually, for example, external feedback can be based on something that's very inaccurate, because it could be somebody's having a bad day. So they've just dished out a judgmental comment, and actually it's nothing to do with you. It's because they've been feeling bad themselves, or perhaps, you know, you might remind somebody of somebody that's hurt their feelings. Mm. So, and often the external feedback kind of has nothing to do with you. It's to do with somebody else's kind of own prejudices and expectations and all those sorts of things. And then our internal self-talk is often to do with, you know, this negativity bias that we've got that's ingrained in us. Again, a survival mechanism to make sure we kind of worry first to prevent anything terrible happening, and also sort of like be quite judgmental, and also on things like comparing ourselves to others, mm. Which again, as we know, you know, the whole compare and despair thing, often we're comparing our sort of blooper reel, if you like, to everybody else's highlights reel. So again, that's very inaccurate. Mm. You know, there's a phrase I say in the book, which is something like, the grass is greener because it's astroturf. Because yeah. often, you know, it's glossy and shiny, and people aren't showing their true wholesale selves, because we can't do that. So yeah, all the external thing is obviously very is it can be inaccurate, and so can the internal.
It is interesting, isn't it, this whole judgmental thing, because you know, I get the hardwiring for approval bit, you know, we want to fit in, we want to be accepted, I get that completely, but I just wonder why we're so many of us are really kind to other people, and you know, whatever their flaws, we accept them, and we, you know, we just sort of go, oh well, it's just how he is, how she is, and but when it comes to ourselves, we are incredibly unkind and very judgmental, and yeah. you know, over dramatize everything, and we literally find it very hard to see. As I mean, somebody wants that lovely description of, you know, in your head, you know, you're this kind of big stick person, and everyone else is a little stick person. But in their head, they're the big stick person. So yeah. you know, we all do this, don't we? So it's a wonder that we can't kind of grasp that and go, oh, do you know what? Maybe other people don't think that I look as terrible as I think I look, or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah, it's so true. We're just very harsh on ourselves. And what's really interesting, is if you think about books and films. We tend to gravitate towards perhaps characters that are imperfect. Like, we like a flawed hero. You know, we like somebody who's got quite a lot to learn, and oh, they've made that mistake, and because we can relate to them, and we like that. We prefer sort of flawed characters are more likable.
And the kind of underdog thing, isn't it? Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we do definitely like that.
Yeah, and yet, when we make mistakes or we are imperfect and flawed, we give ourselves such a hard time. And actually, the irony is we're probably more likable when we're, which is obviously the social acceptance thing, when we are showing our flawed selves and being vulnerable and showing up kind of authentically. And actually, yeah, you know, I'm not very good at this, and I'm winging this, and actually being honest about that. So that's that kind of strange irony that actually when we show up as our true selves, which is flawed, we're probably going to be more more accepted anyway, mm-hmm. rather than perfection and striving for that sort of all these expectations, which I think the expectation side can really get us down. So
yeah, there's that lovely phrase, isn't there, flawsome. You're awesome, yes. but also potentially flawed, and that's okay, yeah, too.
Definitely.
Tell us a bit more about this perfection that we're all reaching for, and the sort of pressures of perfection and expectation. I mean, you touched on it, you know, when you mentioned the sort of the grass is greener. You know, where does the sort of social media fit in? Because obviously it's ramped, the whole thing has ramped up, the expectation has ramped up in recent years, but it has always been the case that we've done this comparing thing, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think what happens is, really, as soon as you're born, unfortunately for parents, it's this, you know, oh, well, they were talking at such and such an age, and oh yes, they're walking now, and you know, in the playground, it's sort of who can run the fastest and who can, you know, you're put into sets sort of for academics, and so and sometimes perhaps with siblings, you know, your one sibling might be amazing at one thing and another at something else, and so it is kind of deeply ingrained in our society that we compare ourselves even before social media. So this sort of pressure to be perfect or to do well. And I think that the answer, I think, perhaps, is to choose different metrics of measurement, because we're measuring each other against everything, whether it's academically or you know, house size or how many holidays a year. And actually, when we stop for a second and think, there's two things we can do, really, is choosing different metrics. So it doesn't have to be about success or academics or whatever. It's you know, what makes you feel alive, and you know, what is it in your life, whether it's having a good hug with somebody you love, or looking at the sunset, remembering to look at the sunset, things like that. Have you done that enough? You know, that can be the metric of, you know, just much more sort of life affirming things like that. And actually measuring, you know, kindness and contribution and love, they can be the metrics that you sort of measure yourself. If you need a metric, you know, have I made someone smile today?
Yeah.
You know, and that can be enough. So I do think, yeah, that it's kind of like going back to that idea of with the comparing as well, is actually, have I been enough me today?
Yeah, you know? I love that. Yeah, I love that. But, you know, we're not taught that in school at all. I mean, we really are not. You know, it's, I mean, what would you like to see change in that respect?
I think it is really, I mean, certainly when it comes to school, is nurturing people's individual spark, and you know, I think the whole don't get me started on education, I think, yeah, there's a lot that could be done there to really sort of find out what people enjoy doing and what they're good at, and then let them focus on that, because that can be their job
absolutely
rather than try and be good at all these different things that actually you might struggle with, and then that can make you feel less than good enough when you know, so I think also really making sure that people, children especially with social media, just reminding them that there's the filter thing, you know, that's lots of things, it's all edited and filters and everything and not real life, and you can't see the whole picture. So, you know, for example, if you think about how we used to share photo albums before social media,
we'd choose the best ones, right?
Yeah, you wouldn't just put, you know, you going to around the supermarket doing your day-to-day stuff, you pick holiday photos
or a picture of your dinner.
Exactly. Yeah, you'd put all the best stuff and that's how you'd you know collate it, and that's really what social media does. And so to compare anything with that, you know, even if you're comparing your best stuff to somebody else's best stuff, you're still not seeing the whole picture. And you know that even the, you know, the perfect family shot of somebody with their soulmate and their, you know, it's all glorious and wonderful. And actually they might have just had the mother of all rows 5 minutes ago, but they didn't share that part.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing. I think we don't share the difficult stuff often, partly because we maybe don't want to, and or partly because it's actually not ours to share. So if you're having a difficulty in your relationship, or so it's not really, that's about somebody else, that would be invading someone else's privacy. They might not want you to talk about that on social media, or some other issue that you're having. It might be private for somebody else, or your child, or any things like that. So you don't share the rough parts, it's only the smooth. So I think we have a tendency to kind of envy up. I think it's it's called envy up or scorn down. So you either envy and think, oh, their life looks so wonderful, or oh well, at least I'm doing better than that person. And actually like I said, if we just sort of choose this more sort of temporal comparison, where we're sort of just measuring our progress perhaps compared to yesterday, so we're more comparing ourselves to how we did yesterday, and that's sort of a bit more healthy way to do it.
I mean, when people are ditching the booze, you know, I hear time and time again people will say, I'm so angry with myself. I'm so useless. I'm so hopeless. And, you know, I ended up having a drink again, and I said I wasn't going to. And there's this sort of barrage of absolute sort of self-hatred, really, comes flying out. And yet the minute they post a message like that on you know, on my group, on the Sober Club, the amount of love shared with them is immense, because not because anyone's saying, well, good for you, you decided to relapse. Everyone's saying, well, you know what, it happens, but what can you learn from it? And how amazing is it that you've noticed it this time, and that you felt like shit? Because, you know, that's a great lesson. You know, and so they get all this kind of love bombing, and then they feel buoyed up again. So, you know, the power of that connection is really important. And I think the danger is when we are alone with our inner critic, that's when it gets really bad, isn't it? When we literally take ourselves off and just listen to that voice of absolute self-hatred.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. Like, share it, like, your mistakes are how we learn, and we know that. But so actually, you know, you're more likely to... if you relapse and you share it with other people and people can relate to it, like you go, okay, what made that happen? And also giving yourself permission to be human, because you know you can't get it right the whole time, and things happen, and you know, sort of falling off the wagon or whatever. If you just get back on, then it's okay, you know. So it's a bit like if you're having, you know, your inner critic, and you really dwell on it and you spend a lot of time there. And I guess the same would be with alcohol. If you relapse and you keep it's continuous and you don't get back on. So I think it's just recognizing this thing and giving yourself a break, and actually knowing that, look, you know, a tiny bit of progress is progress. And if you step back, you fall off, or you do make a mistake, you can learn from it and
get back on the horse, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely.
Talking with Cheryl Rickman, the book is You Are Enough, Embrace Your Flaws and Be Happy Being You. Cheryl, I'm really interested in the way you talk about this whole thing of... our inner committee. You know, we spoke earlier about the voice, you know, the voice in our head that tells us we're not good enough, but you're saying we've got a whole committee in there.
Oh yes, yeah, we have. So you've got sort of the inner critic, And that's kind of driven by this negativity bias that will focus on the one criticism that somebody else may have pointed out, or that you've done, you said something, oh, I shouldn't have said that. Oh, if only I'd not said that, instead of all the wonderful things you've said, you know. So so you've got the inner critic, imposter syndrome obviously pops up.
That's a big one. I've been having a lot of that lately.
Oh yes. But you know, and it's what's so interesting is literally everybody, you know, I think Michelle Obama and all these sort of wonderful people that you think, oh, you know, they're so confident, but everybody has it and thinks, oh gosh, I'm going to get found out. And I think it's accepting that and knowing that that is completely normal, and we do have those that inner committee, shitty committee, as it's sometimes referred to.
I love that. I've heard that one before. Oh my god, yeah. I have to credit you every time. I love it.
Yeah, so that's definitely a thing. I think it's what is important is it's almost imagining you've got a boardroom and you've got these members of your that committee, and then actually sometimes having an inner cheerleader there.
Yeah.
To go, oh, okay, well, yes, you did say that, and perhaps you could have done that differently. But remember the other day when you did this and you were really proud of yourself, and just remember that, and just sort of reminding you of the good stuff.
Yeah.
So you've got sort of an inner cheerleader to sort of combat the inner critic. Mm. And then also like a joy detective, I would say. Mm,
lovely.
Who literally you have to really sometimes really look hard to find the silver lining and find the good and count the blessings and focus on what you've got to be grateful for rather than what you, oh, I wish I had this, and I wish you just think, you know, what you've got now. And, you know, that can be a real good sort of counter to the negativity bias when you really focus on that. And then also just the inner cheerleader side of things, sort of really thinking about your strengths. There's different, I think I might have mentioned it when we spoke before, but there's different things you can find online that sort of tell you a bit more about what your strengths are, like quizzes.
Mm. Yeah.
And there's one called the VIA Strengths, Values in Action, VIA Strengths Finder. Mm-hmm. And it's quite a long, it's like a 25-minute survey, but it's so accurate. And it just tells you things like, you know, that you're really very optimistic, or you've got a lot of zest, or your leadership is one of your strengths. And just sort of reminding yourself of what your strengths are and what you've been through, you know, I think that's key.
Mm. I think most of us don't sort of acknowledge ourselves enough. We never sing our own praises. You know, when I work with people who are, you know, sort of growing their business, and I'm helping them to get that a bit of PR or whatever, you know, I'll ask them to talk about something great about them, and no one can do it. They can tell you the stuff that where it relates to the work they do. So, you know, you might sort of pull out of them eventually, you know, oh, my products are eco-friendly and I'm a good listener and I'm a good team player, but they very rarely can get to the point where they can actually say something fabulous about themselves, because we're really not taught to do that. That's egotistical, allegedly, you know.
That's self-love.
Yeah, exactly. That's self-care, self-love, and all of, and those things have kind of been drummed out of us at a very early age. And certainly in my case, you know, I thought the self-care was the glass of wine. You know, I had no idea what it meant, no idea at all. So what are your sort of top tips for us then? Apart from getting the book, obviously, where can we start? What are a few little things we can, that everyone can do to start to recognize that, you know, we are enough?
One of the can be quite powerful, actually, is digging out a photograph of yourself as a child.
Yeah.
And if you think about, you know, you would never, like the way we speak to ourselves, often people say, or speak to yourself like you would, like a good friend.
Yeah.
And that's great. But also sometimes speak to yourself like you would a child that you really love and care about.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't, the last thing you would do is, you know, like really with vitriol put down a child in a certain way. And yet we speak like that to ourselves all the time. So sometimes finding a photograph of your self as a child, and even sort of taking a photo of it and having it on your phone and just looking at it and just reminding, and sometimes looking at it and thinking, actually, you know, I'm going to be nicer to this person.
Yes, absolutely.
She's doing her best with what she's got, and you know, she's going to mess up sometimes, and that's fine. So that's one way, and that can also lead you to the idea of seeing yourself through the eyes of someone who believes in you, like always seeing yourself, you know, through a friend's eyes or a parent's eyes or somebody, and actually, you know, so you can try and cultivate that sort of self-belief. And I think I'll try and find it in my book. There's I'll read this little snippet, which is about sort of seeing yourself through the eyes of someone who believes in you and sees your potential, and you know, perhaps is even not just a friend but a fan of yours. And I say in the book, seeing yourself as not good enough is like a sunset thinking it's not orange enough, or it's too glowy, or a mountain thinking it's not high enough or too jaggedy. The sunset's amazing, the mountain is amazing, you are amazing. So it's just reminding yourself of that by seeing the best in yourself, and sometimes writing down something nice that someone said about you, because you focus, your negativity bias will focus so much on all the terrible things that you then internalize. Actually, someone said that, you've got really nice eyes, or I love the way you're a really good listener. Just writing that down, and I am a good listener, can internalize it. So sometimes I would say writing down kind of our positive I am statements.
I was working, I was talking to another coach who was saying that, you know, and this is something that we definitely do in NLP, is that we look at the things that we say, you know, that we always say, I'm always this, or I'm never that. You know, it's the always and the never, isn't it? They're the kind of things that, because they've been so ingrained in us, that's what we think we've become. And we all do this. We're all guilty of it. I catch myself. So, I never do that. You know, and then you have, well, hold on. I mean, is that actually a fact? Or is it just a limiting belief that I never do that? Or that I always do something or always say something? So I guess that's, you know, as you say, the, what do you call it? The shoulds. What's your word about the shoulds?
The shackles.
Yeah. Which I guess is the same thing. So how do we deal with the shackles of shoulds then?
I think that there's another sort of phrase of taking your thoughts to court.
Yeah, you mentioned that last time. I love it.
Yeah, just actually questioning some of those thoughts. And actually, if you could find one bit of evidence to that, you know, to support or deny the claim that you're making, that you're terrible, you're never going to be good at this, and actually if you can find one shred of evidence to counter that, then it's obviously not accurate, and you can sort of reframe it. And as far as the shackles of should go, I think there's quite a lot of exercises in the book that you can sort of go through, and for each of these things, like the pressures of perfection and the shackles of should and compare and despair and so on. But one of the things is to kind of think about the shoulds, what are the shoulds that you've been told in your life? Mm-hmm. So it could be, you should, say for example, at work, you know, you should wear very dark clothes and you should be present yourself in a certain way, and actually thinking, well, is that me? And I think it always comes back to, am I being me enough again? And so actually, no, I like colourful things. I am going to wear colour. I can still be smart, but I can wear colourful clothes. So I think it's sort of going back to those, because society does literally sit us down and tell us what we should wear or should.
Well, we're a lot more controllable, aren't we, if we're all doing exactly the same thing?
Yeah, and they can sell more things to us if we think we're, you know, not young looking enough or young. And actually, no. It's very much just going back to measuring ourselves in different ways. And you know, if thinking about your values, what matters to you. So actually, if kindness is a value or honesty is a value, and that's really important to you, then I think you know, sometimes measuring yourself a bit, if you're going to, on those things can combat the shoulds that you're told. Mm. And actually, you know, did I speak kindly to that person, or was I polite, or was I honest? Yes, there you go. That's enough then.
Yeah, exactly. And that's an important point too, because, you know, I think, well, certainly a lot of the people that I work with, if you've been drinking for years, people are often not very good at setting boundaries. Mm. And that they're, you know, huge people pleasers. And so they'll literally start drinking just because somebody else suggests they should. So just to literally kind of hang out with someone else, they'll end up drinking again. And what's really interesting is when you've finally cracked this and you can just sort of step into your new identity, you realize that it is okay to be yourself. And that might mean saying no.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's I should just have a drink because it's the social, you know, to be sociable or whatever. And it's really tuning into what your own integrity. Yeah. And, you know, you've made this decision to which is a great decision to find other you know, to not drink, or to you know, there's life after booze, and yeah, there's lots exactly. of so much. So you've made the decision, so that's what you want to stick to, and that's okay. And also, I think people are accepting, and when you're yourself, I think people really do admire.
Well, I think that's it, isn't it? I think it all comes back to that authenticity that you feel. There's something really very powerful and very attractive about someone who is completely authentic, even though you might not agree with them or you feel the same way. There's a sort of respect, isn't there, when someone is standing in their kind of authenticity.
Definitely. Yeah.
It takes while to get to that, though, don't you think?
Yeah, and it's not hard, and that's because of all these expectations, I think, that we have to live up, we think we have to live up to. But yeah, just recognizing that actually being flawed, which is the human, that's everybody has flaws, but when you remember that actually that's quite what's the word, not redeeming, admirable, can't think of the word.
Well, it's very relatable.
Yeah, it's very relatable, and it's something we admire, really, when you know, like I said, with books and films and stuff, and in real life. So I think it's just acknowledging that, and then just showing up as yourself, and that being okay. And actually, that's so freeing, because that's why I say the shackles of should, because really, when you release them,
yeah,
and you're free just to be yourself. Mm. I do think sometimes this is. It can get easier with age. Mm. I do think there's a sort of period when you're a teenager and in your 20s and stuff that you can be so trapped in this wanting to be liked and peer pressure and everything else. And you can, when you sort of, you start to realize that actually I can stop worrying about what other people think of me, because they're not thinking of me, they're worried about what I think of them. So when you have that kind of light bulb moment, and then obviously you still, the social acceptance and belonging and stuff still matters, but I think it's you can release those shackles of should and just sort of step into your own power and focus on, you know, your strengths, but also embrace and accept your weaknesses as actually sometimes quite attractive, you know.
Definitely. And that's how we get to optimum health and wellness, really, isn't it? Because I think when you're in constant stress and, you know, feeling under judgment and full of these limiting beliefs and sort of arguing with yourself the whole time, it's putting a huge stress on your body, actually.
Yeah, it does. And actually, it doesn't get you anywhere, because you're not then enjoying the journey. Mm. I heard Fern Cotton actually earlier say, she was on her Instagram, and she said that, you know, if you're striving for perfection, you're miserable.
Yeah.
What's the point? You're not enjoying the journey. And I think that's the key thing. I think just thinking about what can I do. One of the other things that I focus on about enoughness is I've been doing this list of delight. I think I mentioned in the previous conversation, and And that's really helpful because it's just the little things like the smell of coffee.
Yeah, I love it.
You know, those tiny things, it doesn't have to be big. And then because there's so much pressure on achievement and you've got to do this and you've got to achieve all these things and do. That's why I've put the book into sort of, you know, being enough, doing enough, looking enough, feeling enough. Am I feeling happy enough? Am I, you know, so there's all these kind of goes across all these things. And I think actually if you just have these small little recognition that of these moments of delight, then you know that's enough. You know that can be enough, and also the have I done enough? You know your to do list. Actually, I did two things, and that's enough.
Yeah,
today.
That's right. Brilliant. So, I love it. Thank you so much, Cheryl Rickman. The book is You Are Enough: Embrace Your Flaws and Be Happy Being You. Thank you so much, Cheryl. It's great to chat to you.
Thank you, Janie. Really enjoyed that conversation. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Cheryl. We'll put the link to the book in the show notes, as well as the info about Undrunk, who do that great monthly subscription box. Depending on when you're listening to this, we have a Family Constellations event on Sunday, Sunday 28th in Hertfordshire. Still a few tickets left if that's of interest. It's a very difficult technique, practice, if you like, to describe, but it leaves you with much more compassion in your heart. I'll leave you with that thought. So if it's of interest, do look at the show notes or go to thesoberclub.com/events and see if you're interested in coming along to our Family Constellations event on Sunday. We do have another Champneys event booked January the 8th. That's at Tring, and another one February 26th at Springs in Leicestershire. And I'm also planning some more Sober by the Sea events as well for next year. They might be slightly different, but let me know if that's something of interest. I must also tell you that my Sobriety Rocks Health Journal is out now. It's one of those kind of hardback journals, 12-week journals. It's got whole sections on, I don't know, keeping track of what's going on, setting your goals and your intentions, a little bit about gratitude, you know, the power of positive thinking. There's a whole bunch of stuff in there. So it's a really nice kind of journal to kick off your any behavior change you want to make, really. And it's not dated to the year, as it were. So you don't have to wait till January if you want to treat yourself now. So if you go to thesoberclub.com and click on shop, you can pick up that Sobriety Rocks Health Journal. I will see you same time next week. Make sure you keep in touch at Janie Lee Grace is all the usual socials. And make sure you tell someone if you're doing this, you know, a huge big up if you're doing this thing, if you're any behavior change you're making right now. Maybe you've been sober for months or even years and now you're tackling something else, and if that's the case, huge big up to you. You can do it. If you can hear drilling going on, that's because there's drilling going on. Very good timing, because I'm just about to finish. Look forward to seeing you same time next week, and have yourself a great week and stay connected. The opposite of addiction is connection, says Johan Harry in his TED talk. Okay. And you know what I say at the end of my TED talk? That's what you need in case the wine witch comes calling. See you soon. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by the Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.